"It is not my fault that I cannot eat or rest," he replied. "I assure you, it is through no settled designs. I'll do both as soon as I possibly can. But you might as well bid a man struggling in the water rest within arm's length of the shore. I must reach it first, and then I'll rest. Well, never mind, Mr. Green. As to repenting of my injustices, I've done no injustice, and I repent of nothing. I'm too happy, and yet I'm not happy enough. My soul's bliss kills my body, but does not satisfy itself."
"Happy, master," I cried. "Strange happiness. If you would hear me without being angry, I might offer some advice that would make you happier."
"What is that?" he asked. "Give it."
"You are aware, Mr. Heathcliff," I said, "that from the time you were 13 years old, you have lived a selfish, unchristian life, and probably hardly had a Bible in your hands during all that period. You must have forgotten the contents of the book, and you may not have space to search it now. Could it be hurtful to send for someone, some minister of any denomination, it does not matter which, to explain it, and show you how very far you have erred from its precepts, and how unfit you will be for its heaven, unless a change takes place before you die?"
"I'm rather obliged than angry, Nelly," he said, "for you to remind me of the manner in which I desire to be buried. It is to be carried to the churchyard in the evening. You and Hareton may, if you please, accompany me. And mind, particularly, to notice that the sexton obeys my directions concerning the two coffins. No minister need come, nor need anything be said over me. I tell you, I have nearly attained my heaven, and that of others is altogether unvalued and uncovered by me."
"And supposing you persevered in your obstinate fast, and died by that means, and they refused to bury you in the precincts of the kirk?" I said, shocked at his godless indifference. "How would you like it?"
"They won't do that," he replied. "If they did, you must have me removed secretly. And if you neglect it, you shall prove practically that the dead are not annihilated."
As soon as he heard the other members of the family stirring, he retired to his den, and I breathed freer. But in the afternoon, while Joseph and Hareton were at their work, he came into the kitchen again, and, with a wild look, bid me come and sit in the house. He wanted somebody with him. I declined, telling him plainly that his strange talk and manner frightened me, and I had neither the nerve nor the will to be his companion alone.
"I believe you think me a fiend," he said with his dismal laugh. "Something too horrible to live under a decent roof."
Then turning to Catherine, who was there, and who drew behind me at his approach, he added half-sneeringly,
"Will you come, Chuck? I'll not hurt you. No. To you I've made myself worse than the devil. Well, there is one who won't shrink from my company. By God, she's relentless. Oh, damn it, it's unutterably too much for flesh and blood to bear, even mine."
He solicited the society of no one more. At dusk he went into his chamber. Through the whole night, and far into the morning, we heard him groaning and murmuring to himself. Hareton was anxious to enter, but I bid him fetch Mr. Kenneth, and he should go in and see him. When he came, and I requested admittance and tried to open the door, I found it locked, and Heathcliff bid us be damned. He was better, and would be left alone. So the doctor went away. The following evening was very wet. Indeed, it poured down till day dawn. And, as I took my morning walk round the house, I observed the master's window swinging open, and the rain driving straight in. "He cannot be in bed," I thought. "Those showers would drench him through. He must be either up or out. But I'll make no more ado. I'll go boldly and look. Having succeeded in obtaining entrance with another key, I ran to unclose the panels, for the chamber was vacant. Quickly pushing them aside, I peeped in. Mr. Heathcliff was there, laid on his back. His eyes met mine so keen and fierce, I started, and then he seemed to smile. I could not think him dead, but his face and throat were washed with rain, the bedclothes dripped, and he was perfectly still. The lattice, flapping to and fro, had grazed one hand that rested on the sill. No blood trickled from the broken skin, and when I put my fingers to it, I could doubt no more. He was dead and stark. I hasped the window. I combed his black long hair from his forehead. I tried to close his eyes, to extinguish, if possible, that frightful, lifelike gaze of exultation before anyone else beheld it. They would not shut. They seemed to sneer at my attempts, and his parted lips and sharp white teeth sneered too. Taken with another fit of cowardice, I cried out for Joseph. Joseph shuffled up and made a noise, but resolutely refused to meddle with him.
"The divil's harried off his soul," he cried, "and he may have his carcass into t' bargain for aught I care. Eck! What a wicked, and he looks gurning at death."
And the old sinner grinned in mockery. I thought he intended to cut a caper round the bed, but suddenly composing himself, he fell on his knees, and raised his hands, and returned thanks that the lawful master and the ancient stock were restored to their rights. I felt stunned by the awful event, and my memory unavoidably recurred to former times with a sort of oppressive sadness. But poor Hareton, the most wronged, was the only one who really suffered much. He sat by the corpse all night, weeping in bitter earnest. He pressed its hand and kissed the sarcastic, savage face that everyone else shrank from contemplating, and bemoaned him with that strong grief which springs naturally from a generous heart, though it be tough as tempered steel. Mr. Kenneth was perplexed to pronounce of what disorder the master died. I concealed the fact of his having swallowed nothing for 4 days, fearing it might lead to trouble, and then I am persuaded he did not abstain on purpose. It was the consequence of his strange illness, not the cause. We buried him, to the scandal of the whole neighbourhood, as he wished. Earnshaw and I, the sexton, and 6 men to carry the coffin, comprehended the whole attendance. The 6 men departed when they had let it down into the grave. We stayed to see it covered. Hareton, with a streaming face, dug green sods and laid them over the brown mould himself. At present, it is as smooth and verdant as its companion mounds, and I hope its tenant sleeps as soundly. But the country folks, if you ask them, would swear on the Bible that he walks. There are those who speak to having met him, near the church and on the moor, and even within this house. Idle tales, you'll say, and so say I. Yet that old man by the kitchen fire affirms he has seen 2 on 'em, looking out of his chamber window on every rainy night since his death. And an odd thing happened to me about 1 month ago. I was going to the Grange one evening, a dark evening, threatening thunder, and just at the turn of the heights I encountered a little boy with a sheep and 2 lambs before him. He was crying terribly, and I supposed the lambs were skittish and would not be guided. "What is the matter, my little man?" I asked.
"There's Heathcliff and a woman yonder under Nab," he blubbered, "and I daren't pass them."
I saw nothing, but neither the sheep nor he would go on, so I bid him take the road lower down. He probably raised the phantoms from thinking as he traversed the moors alone, on the nonsense he had heard his parents and companions repeat. Yet still, I don't like being out in the dark now, and I don't like being left by myself in this grim house. I cannot help it. I shall be glad when they leave it and shift to the Grange.
They are going to the Grange, then, I said. Yes, answered Mrs. Dean, as soon as they are married, and that will be on New Year's Day. And who will live here, then? Why, Joseph will take care of the house, and perhaps a lad to keep him company. They will live in the kitchen, and the rest will be shut up, for the use of such ghosts as choose to inhabit it, I observed. No, Mr. Lockwood, said Nelly, shaking her head, I believe the dead are at peace. But it is not right to speak of them with levity. At that moment the garden gate swung to. The Ramblers were returning. They are afraid of nothing, I grumbled, watching their approach through the window. Together they would brave Satan and all his legions. As they stepped onto the doorstones and halted to take a last look at the moon, or, more correctly, at each other by her light, I felt irresistibly impelled to escape them again, and, pressing a remembrance into the hand of Mrs. Dean, and disregarding her expostulations at my rudeness, I vanished through the kitchen, as they opened the house door. And so should have confirmed Joseph in his opinion of his fellow servant's gay indiscretions, had he not fortunately recognized me for a respectable character by the sweet ring of a sovereign at his feet. My walk home was lengthened by a diversion in the direction of the kirk. When beneath its walls, I perceived decay had made progress even in 7 months. Many a window showed black gaps deprived of glass, and slates jutted off here and there beyond the right line of the roof, to be gradually worked off in coming autumn storms. I sought and soon discovered the three headstones on the slope next the moor. The middle one, grey and half-buried in the heath, Edgar Linton's only harmonised by the turf and moss creeping up its foot, Heathcliff's, still bare. I lingered round them under that benign sky, watched the moths fluttering among the heath and harebells, listened to the soft wind breathing through the grass, and wondered how anyone could ever imagine unquiet slumbers for the sleepers in that quiet earth. Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte was read by Janet McTeer and David Timpson.